Okay, 3, 2.
3, 2, hit it!
It's time to double down with Max and Stacy on Sputnik Radio. Now, coming up on the show, we talk to Valentin Schmidt. He's the business editor of the Epoch Times. But first, Adam Smith once said, "Every man lives by exchanging." If you look around, you see he was indeed right. In America, for example, we live by exchanging insults. From the streets of New York, "Hey, you moron, I said I wanted a schmear on my bagel," to Twitter, where the president of the United States can regularly be found calling various citizens losers and crybabies. In China, however, it appears they actually believe in exchanging in such a manner as Adam Smith might recognize. Correct, Stacy?
This topic is important because it was not actually really covered in the U.S. press, but on Sunday, we saw many world leaders, including Vladimir Putin. We saw Nawaz Sharif from Pakistan. We saw Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar. They all arrived in Beijing for a big conference about the Belt and Road Initiative. And the headline reads, "The $900 billion question, what is the Belt and Road Initiative?" In concrete terms, no pun intended, Max, it is an initiative that is immensely ambitious development through which China wants to boost trade and stimulate economic growth across Asia and beyond with railroads, infrastructure projects, maritime projects, which is part of the actual road. The maritime element of it is the road, and the belt is the, you know, the trains that go from China to London. So it's all about trade.
Yeah. Well, you know, the partners that have been left out of the American century are banding together to give America a bit of a competition in the 21st century, aren't they? So obviously there's a lot of tension with Russia and America right now. China, though, is, I think, siding up with Russia and all the countries in the region to put together this one belt, one roadway, which is a very confusing branding that they have for this thing because it includes maritime activities. So I'm not sure how you get a maritime out of a belt or a road, but it's supposed to be sounding better in Chinese from what I understand. But that's not the point. That's not directed to me. I'm not the guy. I'm not the market for this. It's for those billions of people in East, in China, in Russia. This is really underreported, I would say, is a fair statement. And I don't know why, because it's fundamentally redoing a huge infrastructure project. This has got to be one of the biggest infrastructure projects ever.
Well, there are plans for pipelines, a port in Pakistan, bridges in Bangladesh, railways to Russia. McKinsey puts this down at about $150 billion a year are going to be spent over the next 10 years, so $1 trillion. In Chinese, it's called Yi Dei, Yi Lu. Apparently, it sounds actually better in Chinese, not better than it does in English. So to get more on this, we're going to turn to Valentin Schmidt from the Epoch Times. He covers business for them, economic stories, and of course he covers lots about China, the Belt and Road Initiative. Tell us about it. What is the aim? What is the ambition for China with this initiative?
Hey, Max and Stacy, nice to see you. First of all, Max, I would like to know why you mentioned Adam Smith in exchange, because this is one of the biggest central planning initiatives I've recently come across. But jokes aside, what Stacy is asking, why are the Chinese doing it? And it's very simple. They want control and they want influence over their neighbors. So they started this initiative a couple of years ago. And also your question, why is it not reported if there's so much money at stake? It was reported a lot when it started, but, you know, times changed. So first of all, the Chinese had 4 trillion in currency reserves 2013, 2014. Then they had the initiatives with the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. And so this thing, it looked like they could spend up to $1 trillion a year, in fact, to build all those projects that you mentioned. But things have changed in different ways. First of all, the Chinese have lost $1 trillion in reserves, which means that people are pulling money out. It's not that they have to spend the money and diversify it in investment projects abroad. No, the citizens are pulling the money out and they're buying New York real estate and U.S. equities and you name it, and gold and Bitcoin. And so that has changed. So there's a financing problem, and I'll get into that in detail. And then, of course, in terms of media coverage, you know that the media has their capacity and they have their agenda. And now you have a North Korea and you have a Trump, as Max mentioned, and the media may not have the capacity. But to get back to your initial question about the objectives, very clear control, influence of trade in the region, building the allies like Max mentioned with Europe and Russia, and also getting the contracts to the heavy industry companies so they can secure employment in the intermediate future.
We could all tell from your accent and from your name that you're a German. So this is compared to the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was also central planning that went with the U.S. essentially at a time recognizing that they were now the world power. After the devastation of World War II, all the economies of Europe were wiped out. Britain lost its empire. It was over for them. The U.S. stepped up to the plate. Right now, when you look at the media in America, when you look at the economy in America, you see devastation here as well. You see the Rust Belt. You see people unemployed, addicted to opioids. It is a different sort of devastation, but it's still a devastation. Isn't this a sort of, if China wants to step up to the plate, they need their near neighbors. They need the infrastructure. They need trading partners, just like America did after World War II. It was all well and good, America being the only power left standing at the end of World War II. But they needed trading partners if they wanted to enjoy vast wealth that they did become through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then they began to lose it after that.
Hey, look, some of those central planning decisions, they work out by coincidence, maybe 1 in 100 times, but surely the Marshall Plan of the big war in Europe that helped Europe. And you're right, the analogy is good because actually, the Americans, they lent the money and the Europeans rebuilt and the Americans exported capital. It helped the American industry, and then the Europeans they repaid it with exports to America. And I think China, they have the same. It's not that they are giving away the money. No, they're lending it through official channels or through the state banking system, and they are expecting the repayment. But the problem always with that is, so which countries are you investing in? And there are already signs that some countries won't be able to repay, because I remind you that when it comes to central planning and infrastructure investments, the Chinese themselves, they don't have the best track record in generating high value products. Yes, it's useful, but is it valuable?
I want to also say this project, the One Belt, One Road initiative, did begin in 2013 when I believe the last of those Marshall Plan loans were paid off by the UK. I don't know whether Germany or France have finished paying off their loans.
Well, you know, the infrastructure, it typically is a state-backed project. Remember Eisenhower and the interstate highway system in America post-World War II gave birth to, you know, enormous economic growth. The railway system in America, I guess that was more, these were various private companies were slugging it out, but there was, they had to engage in eminent domain and get all that property in cooperation with the government to lay that railway. And, you know, the Chinese folks, you know, they have come out of their communist period as some hybrid of state planned capitalism. It's worked for them. They are putting together the infrastructure. They've got potentially a huge winner on their hands here. I mean, obviously, with these types of projects, you know, I think back to projects like the Eurotunnel, which is nowhere near the scale, but it went over budget. It took 20, 30 years for people to get their money back. It was mired in problems. I mean, I understand that the financing of these projects is problematic and takes a long time, but what is the alternative in this case? I mean, if they wanted to jumpstart their economy for the 21st century and they wanted to build, you know, infrastructure projects going from all across thousands and thousands of miles and different fronts, what would be the alternative to having the state kind of coordinate something like that? What do you think, Valentin?
Well, that's an interesting question. Are we getting more into the theories? And I would agree that on the level of thinking that we have right now, the system that we have right now, yes, that seems to be the plausible option, because the state, and especially in China, controls most of the capital allocation and the private sector is left behind, as it is, you know, in many cases in the Western world. Again, two different things. You talk about the Eurotunnel, you talk about the Marshall Plan, and always with state infrastructure and building investment, you have to talk about corruption. Now, corruption is less endemic in Europe, but it's less endemic in Europe and the United States. It's definitely crazy endemic in China, and it is also endemic in those countries that they're investing in. So you have a higher risk of slippage in terms of corruption. And then second, again, if you look at the capital allocation process, and I believe personally that this goes for capital projects, high capital projects as well. If you think about it, who is building this stuff? It's contractors who are building it. It's private companies who are building it. And who is ultimately supplying the capital? Yeah, you know, the state, you know, basically steals money from a citizen through taxation, so confiscates their capital to then allocate it to these projects. So if we have the ultimate capital coming from the private sector building it, why can't the private sector also, through a competitive system and a profit motive, come to realize those projects? And I know I'm talking about more idealistically here.
Yeah, well, let me give you an example of what the problem is there sometimes. And first of all, you know, I understand you're looking at this as, let's say, an analyst, and you're looking at the rating the bonds and saying, you know, is this an A bond, a B bond? Is it junk bond? Is it, you know, would I invest in this bond? That's one way to look at it. But philosophically, as you point out, there is another way to look at this. And if you look at, for example, the United Kingdom, they opened up their transportation system to private contractors. They gave private contractors the signaling contract, another contractor the stations, another contractor the rolling stock, and they don't work together. And it's worse than when it was totally socialized and it was state-owned. The transportation system there is a mess because all these contractors think that they're competing with each other to get people from point A to point B. In other words, in those instances where you need to get people across the entire country, you don't want subcontractors competing with each other in that scenario because people are not going to get to point B. They may get not to point B in a cheaper, more efficient way, but they won't get to point B. You see what I'm saying? In the UK, it has been a disaster. So, but not to take away from your point that there's rampant corruption, and maybe as a credit analyst, you know, you look at this and say, they're never going to get the money. I wouldn't put a nickel into it. But nevertheless, you know, I'm not sure private enterprise is the great beacon of hope to put together a scale this project.
Yeah, like you say, in this context, and with the motives that we have, with the capital allocation process that we have, being mostly in state hands, yeah, if the Chinese state wants to project power, get contracts for its industry, and develop captive markets, then that's the logical step.
Let me ask you another philosophical question. So the Roman Empire, it's a centralized empire, and they dominated the world, and they built rail system. They built roads, and those roads became the envy of the Western world. And then the reason they fell is because some upstart guy, you know, started a new religion called Christianity, and he used those roads. Just the apostles went on those roads, and Christianity became huge. So China is putting up an infrastructure. That infrastructure can be used in lots and lots of different ways. Would there be potential for competing ideologies and philosophies and ideas now getting currency all over the country because there's wide open roads? You know, in other words, see what I'm saying? They're opening this up to a lot of different things. Not the state of the Communist Party is going to be dealing with a lot of different ideological competition if you can move around freely on these transportation networks.
I like that idea, Max. I like freedom. I like trade also. And this, again, it's this funny point that you cannot argue that the stuff the Chinese have built in their own country and they may be building now in Asia is not useful. The question is it valuable? Will it generate a profit? And couldn't the private sector have made a better capital allocation decision? Now, to your question about the ideologies, I think in the 21st century, that's a bit, you know, out of date because we have the internet and the Chinese are trying to censor the internet, but there are means and ways around it. And the Chinese, they know what's happening in the West. They know what's going on elsewhere. So in terms of that, if anything, more freedom in that regard will have more competition for the communist ideology than anything else.
Before we wrap up, because we do have to go, but I did want to say, and we didn't get a chance to get to it, but the maritime angle of it is expanding trade to Africa. And after 50 years of a Western, you know, U.S. dominated empire, it's still a basket case of Africa. Nothing but charity was given to them. So the fact that trade might be actually coming to Africa once again, like it was 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, and railways being built across Africa, I think that could be a good sign for them.
All right, super. Well, that's it for this episode of Double Down with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. Thanks to our guest, Valentin Schmidt of Epoch Times. Until next week, bye, y'all.